Boop.
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 Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Daruk. President Trump is doubling down on his bet that tariffs will work to change our trading partners' behavior. In fact, he may be betting one of his greatest assets on it, the economy. Last Thursday, Trump announced that if Mexico does not move to stem illegal immigration and the flow of asylum seekers from Central America, he is going to levy tariffs, starting at 5%, on all Mexican goods starting on June 10th. This is after a more than year-long trade war with China that appears to be escalating. So what are the risks and possible rewards for Trump, and how does the issue of free trade figure into our two-party politics? Here with me to discuss that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
It's going well. Thank you, Galen.
Fabulous. And senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good, Galen.
Great to hear. Micah is out today, but Amelia Thompson-DeVoe is going to be joining us later.
Where's Micah?
He's out today.
Okay.
Amelia is going to be joining us later, though, as we discuss a new series here at 538. More women are running for president than ever before. And Claire's looking at how they're navigating questions of identity, sexism, and public critique. Her first profile, looking specifically at Kamala Harris's experience, came out last week. So we'll talk about Harris specifically. And then also Amelia is reporting on the role that sexism plays in politics and in the race for the White House. So we will get into that. But first, let's begin with President Trump's trade wars. And here are the specifics. As of June 1st, the tariff rate on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods increased from 10% to 25%. Anything that's not currently affected by a tariff could be by late June or early July. Then also, last week, Trump threatened a 5% tariff on Mexican goods that would go into effect on June 10th and increase monthly until reaching 25% in October. All right, guys. So let's start with the basics here. Why exactly is Trump levying tariffs on Chinese and now likely on June 10th, Mexican goods?
Gosh, how to frame this? On the Mexican side of things, I think they certainly have to do with his immigration stance, right? The idea that he is painting Mexico as a bad actor that is sort of purposely screwing with the U.S. and he's sort of taking to task, you know, NAFTA and Bill Clinton era trade agreements. China, I think, is a really interesting boogeyman for the past, you know, I'd say a couple decades in American life and American politics. Trump is certainly not the first politician to say, listen, to China is an economic threat. It's not the same kind of, you know, capitalist liberal democracy that we're used to dealing with. We should be really on edge about them. They are taking our manufacturing jobs. And so I think he's created these policies in a way to kind of react to sort of satisfy a impulse that I think exists in American society, which is to say, these are the villains. These are the people that are taking our manufacturing jobs. Let's punish them. It's a punitive action.
I mean, I think part of the background to this is that Trump does not recognize, I guess, the consensus viewpoint of both neoliberal and usually somewhat conservative economists that tariff costs are ultimately borne, at least in part, by the consumer, and therefore with the risk of increasing inflation or reducing consumer demand, and are creating problems because of retaliation from China, for example, about goods that we would export into China. So, you know, for Mexico, it's obviously a way to, like, draw attention to his increasingly creative, as you might call it, ways to try to fight immigration. And he says Mexico has to find ways to be tougher on immigration or else this will kind of go up by 5% per month. For China, I mean, it is more within the realm of economic policy, and there are concerns about their treatment of U.S. intellectual property and so forth. And we're not experts, by the way, in trade policy. We're experts in politics. But I think he overestimates both the economic and political benefit of this. I think this is a politically a dumb choice.
Let's get into some of the risks involved. But it's also worth mentioning when it comes to the why that tariffs can be implemented by Trump basically without Congress. And so this is one of the tools he has that he can use on his own without working with Democrats or even Republicans who, in this case, don't particularly agree with his view on free trade.
Yeah, and the Republicans are, it's interesting because since they don't actually have to have a vote on stuff, right, a lot of Republicans are quite happy to say they do not like these tariffs at all. You know, John Cornyn, for example, is the Republican senator from Texas, said it's going to be especially bad for Texas if you have an effect on the Mexican economy. But there's not a lot they can do about it.
Okay, so what are the risks for Trump of implementing these tariffs?
Well, the economy could do poorly. You see a lot of the economists for say, banks like Goldman Sachs coming out and saying the fact that Trump has implemented these policies doesn't forecast well for international markets. So they were saying that the worried activity bears closest resemblance to when the government shutdown happened. You know, the idea mm-hmm. that these are shocks to the market. You know, the idea is the president is kind of supposed to be a calming influence, you know, steady at the till. And I think that a lot of people in finance are worried by the trend.
I mean, you know, tariffs are responsible, at least in part, for economic catastrophes such as the Great Depression.
What? What was that?
I mean, what do you mean?
She's asking you what the Great Depression was.
Oh, that was a really bad recession where people were really depressed for a long time. You know, I used to think that like
that everyone was like that Dust Bowl
I used
woman.
To think that like
just very sad.
Since all newsreel footage of the Great Depression was in like black and white, I used to think that literally the Great Depression was in black and white.
No, but have you seen this is actually white. I mean, I shouldn't make a joke about the Dust Bowl woman because it's like a very famous, very actually sad photograph of like the Okies like moving to California. That woman was something like 30 years old when that photograph was taken, and there was this series a couple years ago where they put the Dust Bowl famous series, I think it was Dorothea Lange, into color photographs, and it's so crazy because it does make it look You're like, oh, they were real people. They were real people. Yeah, which is such a stupid, you know, like,
oh, wow.
A silly thing. I felt the same way watching the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary because like, he had a lot of the footage in color. And it was just kind of, you know, I was so used to seeing it in still frames, black and white. Sorry, this is a tangent about how cool color photography is and how it makes us be more empathetic. Anyway, Nate, you were talking about the Great Depression.
How much would it hurt GDP if there was no color?
So, anyway. Basically, I mean, the overarching theme is, as I said, that the economy has been doing pretty well since Trump took office. Very well, you could say. And the way that this is being talked about is that, you know, he's like risking the economy if he keeps ramping up tariffs, that there could be a global recession potentially or something along those lines. So the question here is, we always say, oh, the reason that Trump is in the 40s and not the 30s or whatever is because of the economy. What's the evidence for that? And is he really risking... Is that what's on the line? The economy is Trump's popularity?
You're the poll guy.
What's the evidence for? I mean, the evidence is historical connections between presidential popularity and the economy, really. You know, we haven't had a good test of it in Trump's presidency because the economy has kind of uniformly been pretty good, or you might even say very good, during Trump's tenure in office. I mean, we've had some quarters where, like, GDP bounced around, I think, to, like, as high as 4 or as low as 2, by the way. This current quarter that we're in, the Atlanta Fed's nowcast. I think they stole that nowcast idea from us.
We're watching you, Atlanta yeah. Fed.
Well, we got rid of it, so they can have it.
Yeah, you can have the nowcast, Atlanta Fed.
They're definitely listening. All of them, just huddled around the radio.
They forecast 1.3% GDP growth this quarter, which is fairly low, although last quarter's number was thought to be kind of artificially high for technically a reason. Sometimes, therefore, you're reverting from that. The point is the economy has been doing quite well. Lowest unemployment rate in, what is it, like 50 years?
The 70s, yeah.
Low inflation also.
Or 60s, yeah.
And to varying degrees, this could threaten that. I mean, I don't want to like make it seem like there's some tipping point, right? And even if you do go back to that Great Depression example, the tariffs were thought to exacerbate it but not be the only cause. But yeah, I mean, you're kind of gambling with this one thing that's a big asset. And the way you can kind of tell this is by looking at like, ask people, hey, do you feel that Trump is honest or not, right? And it's like 33% yes and 60% no, right? And like all these other things, do you think the president, do you approve of him being on Twitter all the time, whatever else, all the kind of other distractions.
He's in the 30s. And so you're using that as a comparison point for when you specifically ask about the economy, he's in the 50s or he's doing significantly better than in those other cases.
Yeah, they're often in like, you know, 51% or something like that, which for a president with a 41 or 42% overall approval, that's pretty good. You know, my heuristic is that in assessments of, it's going to sound overly specific, right? But in assessments of presidents, that the economy is somewhere between one quarter and one half of what voters care about. that's kind of a heuristic based on looking at lots of models, and there are all types of concerns actually with some of these models where they'll like cherry pick the data they use and overfit the model the term has caused. But it's definitely like a fairly big chunk of like the way the public evaluates presidents.
I feel like we should stop here and say that protectionist trade policies were actually quite the issue du jour during 2016, right? I remember being at the Democratic National Convention, and there were, you know, the chant that Bernie Sanders supporters were doing when they were protesting basically the confirmation of Clinton as nominee was no TPP, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that became, you know, for some Trump supporters, certainly for Sanders supporters, a even if people didn't know the detailed policies of TPP, they knew that it stood for we're against countries that take advantage of workers, right? That are drawing companies overseas, outsourcing, and, you know, taking away jobs from the Southeast, from the Midwest, things like that. And, you know, I always thought it would have been interesting if Sherrod Brown had gotten into the Democratic primary race this year, because he's a person who has been consistently for, you know, a couple decades promoting these more protectionist U.S. trade policies. Now, someone like Sanders has been critical, I think, of the way that Trump has gone about some of this trade policy stuff. But I think that there were more, you know, things like labeling China a currency manipulator was something that Sanders promoted. So there was this idea that, listen, America is getting taken advantage of in the global marketplace in part because we have certain standards of a liberal democracy that China doesn't have, because it is not a liberal democracy. It's more of, you know, state control and different standards of health and safety for workers and for products. But I do think that there has been a sense in America that we as a country are not doing well on that global sphere with trade policy.
To that point, Nate, so far, the economy has not taken like the hit that these Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs types are projecting if the quote-unquote trade war keeps ramping up. So without that kind of major economic impact, what do Americans think about the tariffs on China so far?
I mean, first, I'm not sure that you would necessarily say that, oh, these kind of theories about trade wars have been disproven.
Oh, at least there hasn't been enough. Maybe the tariffs aren't high enough. Maybe they haven't been levied on enough goods. But there hasn't been some major impact to revert how people generally feel about the economy, the unemployment rate, things like that. So given where we are now, what do Americans think about the tariffs?
I mean, so let's back up a little bit and talk about kind of free trade in general.
Mm-hmm.
In general, the Bernie bros and Bernie sisters who were screaming about TPP on the floor of the Democratic Convention are in a minority of Democrats and a minority of the public. So among Democrats, this is data from Pew, currently 67% say that free trade agreements are a good thing and 19% say they're a bad thing. That number is actually up since Trump took office. And I think some Democrats are like, well, if Trump...
The number of people who think it's a good thing is up.
Yeah, but it was always... Free trade was always popular among actually both parties most of the time, but Democrats more consistently so. But again, Trump's in office. He's, I guess, anti-free trade. So Democrats are like, oh, therefore free trade must be a good thing. And for Republicans, it's bounced around quite a lot, where kind of briefly in the middle of the 2016 campaign, free trade became quite unpopular and it's since kind of rebounded more to parity. And remember, there are like a lot of establishment Republicans for whom free trade is like kind of gospel. So it's been a bit more volatile. But I do think like this is actually an issue on which the punditry about populism is kind of wrong, and that this is maybe not the best battle for Trump to pick, and maybe also not the best battle for a Democratic candidate to pick. I mean, we've seen in this nomination process some liberal Democrats struggling to gain as much traction as they would. And I would say if you're a liberal Democrat, then like probably talk about minimum wage or something like that, or healthcare and not free trade.
Wait, but doesn't the fact that it bounces around so much, right? So like looking at this, in 2009, 31% of Republicans said that free trade agreements were a bad thing. And then in 2016, it was 63%. So it like more than doubled. I mean, doesn't that just mean that people don't really care that much and will follow the cues of who leadership is?
Maybe. I mean, but maybe it may also be that Republicans are enamored with their president, who's very popular among them. And so therefore he can shift things a lot, but there isn't necessarily a comfortable Democrat who could. And in general, people are not thrilled with Trump's policy toward China. A CBS News poll from last month said 47% of the public thinks that because of this China stuff, it will make the economy worse. Only 24% says better. there is a big contingent that says we're not really sure about any of this. We are not economists. Why are you asking us, you weird pollsters? But in general, you know, I think there's not been any high quality polling on Mexico yet as we tape this. But it's just things going to hit consumers, right? I mean, Mexico's main imports to the U.S. include a lot of autos and auto parts. So that would be felt fairly directly, can be a big component in inflation or heavy duty machinery. Less food than you would think. You would think there are a lot of food imports from Mexico to the U.S., but there is some avocados and so forth. I'm sure the millennials will be very outraged by the increase in the price of avocados.
That's an avocado toast reference to anybody who's not familiar enough with millennials to get that reference.
But there is stuff, you know, so washers and dryers are a segment that has been impacted by the Chinese tariffs, for example. And so that's fairly visible to consumers. What's happened, by the way, is that some of the American washer and dryer manufacturers have raised their prices because now the Chinese washers and dryers are more expensive. They're like, okay, well, we're going to profit from this too, but it hurts the consumer. So this is like potentially fairly visible when you have, when I don't know, I guess people are not buying autos every day, right? But it's going to be reflected in the sticker prices.
Flat screen TVs too.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, yeah. People buy those, I guess, more frequently than autos. So to wrap this up, Claire, in weighing the potential upside for Trump in, I don't know, getting that trade deal with China that he says is fair, you know, that he really wants, or getting Mexico to take action on immigration, how much upside is there in comparison to the risks, I guess, that Trump is taking here with these tariffs?
I mean, you know, you look at the polling numbers and people have always been sort of pessimistic about having a trade war. They've gotten slightly more pessimistic about the idea of a trade war. I mean, sure, if Trump forces, you know, kind of bullies Mexico into a corner to make some sort of concession on, you know, immigration, that seems the most likely thing. I don't know how likely that is. But yeah, sure, maybe there's an upside. But honestly, I don't think trade wars generally play out well for the countries involved in general. And so I trust on this small segment of economic analysis, the economists who work for banks and large institutions where they say, this is probably not going to be good for the markets. What if we're seeing the bubblings of a recession? So while it might be kind of flashy in a political posturing sense right now, I think we don't know how it's going to look a year or two down the line. And that's when it kind of becomes important to voters when they're casting their ballots in how many months? 17?
18, something like that. It's also worth saying that, you know, if you read some of the reporting about the Trump administration's position on China, you'll hear that, okay, part of this is trying to get a better trade deal, but part of this is also a view that China's generally bad and promoting this idea of decoupling our economies, right? So that in the long term, we're less reliant on Chinese manufacturing overall, regardless of whether they agree with our trade deals. So kind of coming back to how the parties are reacting to this, Democrats being way more negative on Trump's policies than Republicans, of course. Is this playing into a broader realignment between the two parties? Like, obviously, business doesn't like the trade war or tariffs. I mean, is this going to drive corporations to be like, oh, maybe we like the Democrats more if they're going to, you know, be in favor of free trade?
In that sense, it syncs up with the realignment of, let's say, college-educated voters, particularly white college-educated voters who used to vote more Republican, voting more Democratic. If you're gonna profile white college-educated Democrats, that might be the demographic of people who work for large companies, right? For people who are thinking about which party is better for my interests. Is it Trump's trade protectionist party, or is it the Democrats who are kind of reacting to Trump's trade protectionist policies? And the Democratic mainstream is, the party itself has trade protectionist, but the mainstream of the Democratic Party is ultimately going to be a more free trade friendly capitalist, even if they have a rhetoric of regulated capitalism. We're maybe more comfortable with those people because they seem more predictable. I think generally you might say that the captains of industry are not cool, not down with populism, and Trump does seem to have sort of populist instincts on this particular economic issue.
Although we're saying that on many other economic issues that he's spoken in populist ways about, he hasn't necessarily like followed through.
Very true. He's an idiosyncratic guy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I guess the benefit is if somehow Mexico decides that we are going to do some crackdowns on the flow of migrants, then he can rescind the tariffs and claim victory later on, right? We're also negotiating a new NAFTA.
And I think it's actually the U.S.-Mexico Canada Agreement.
Yeah.
Isn't that what it's now being called?
Well, we wanted the
love a rebrand.
Trump wanted America First in that. What's the new acronym?
I don't even think. I think it hardly even has one. There's just so many words.
USMCA.
Happy USMCA.
Yeah, the United States Mexico Canada Agreement. USMCA.
Okay, there you go.
Micah, so, we're here. He could object, but
as you were saying,
so maybe this could threaten USMCA, for example. I'm trying to popularize that. I'm trying to push that. And that would probably not be a great accomplishment for Trump. But yeah, in theory, you can rescind this whenever you want and say, oh, we achieved victory X and Y, and there's some kabuki around it, right? And he's not necessarily like that profoundly committed to going the distance with this kind of 5% increases every time, right? And Trump will just kind of forget about things and rescind things, and the news cycle will move on, right? And so, yeah, so maybe it's like not that existential a threat necessarily, but this is like in a large bundle of things that Trump does, I'd say you're probably not helping yourself here, bud. You know, you've got a good economy. Maybe it's you're doing, maybe not, but like you're probably not helping yourself here, dude. Just let go, man. Just play some golf.
All right.
Let's play some golf, man. Just let the economy do its thing and you'll win re-election.
You more heard it here, golf. Folks. Nate Silver's campaign strategy for Donald Trump, more golf. Anyway,
like literally, if he just played golf from now until next November, would he get reelected?
Like, and didn't tweet. Like, literally just played golf and.
I mean, if there's like an emergency, he'll go visit the town that was afflicted by the emergency and go golf there, maybe. But yeah, if he just golfs.
I don't know. Listeners, write in. What do you think? Anyway, let's move on and talk about Kamala Harris and how women in the race are navigating questions about their identities. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Finding a new job is a lot of work. But what if you had your own personal recruiter to help you find a better job? Now, ZipRecruiter's technology can do exactly that for you. Just download the ZipRecruiter job search app, let it know what kind of jobs you're interested in, and its technology starts doing the work. The ZipRecruiter app finds jobs you'll like and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone like you. If an employer likes your profile, ZipRecruiter lets you know, so if you're interested in the job, you can apply. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job search app. And based on a third-party survey, 7 out of 10 people who found a new job on ZipRecruiter increased their salaries. Those were the results of a 2017 U.S. survey of over 500 ZipRecruiter users who got hired for a job they found on ZipRecruiter. Download the free ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job. That's the ZipRecruiter job search app. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. Looking for a way to save some extra money this summer? Why not start by paying less interest on your credit card balances? Refinance with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. It's an easy way to save hundreds of thousands of dollars and lower your interest rate. Lightstream offers credit card consolidation loans from 5.95% APR with AutoPay. There are absolutely no fees, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's LIGHTSTREAM.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. Lightstream.com/538. There are more high-profile women vying for the Democratic nomination than ever before this year. We at 538, on the website and here on this podcast, are paying attention to how these women are running and how they're being received. Senior writer Amelia Thompson DeVoe is reporting on the role that sexism plays in American politics and specifically the race for president. So welcome, Amelia. Thank you for joining us today.
Of course. Happy to be here.
And Claire is also writing about how these different women are navigating a race that has historically not had many women in it. Her first profile in the series about Kamala Harris came out last week, and I encourage everyone to go check it out. It's called Kamala Harris is More Interested in Telling You What She Believes Than Who She Is. So, Claire, to kick us off, what's the idea behind this sort of series that you're working on about how the various women in the race are navigating questions about their identity and so on?
Yeah. Well, obviously, 2020 has a lot of women running for president. I think that in 2016, there was a lot of attention, obviously, because Hillary Clinton was the first major party nominee. But Hillary Clinton was also such a specific, well-known character in American life. And people seem to sort of project all these things about, well, this is what happens if a woman runs for president. It's all going to be like how Hillary Clinton did. But Hillary Clinton is a person of millions and billions of people, and she had one experience running for president. What I think is really interesting about this election and about the female candidates is that they're all different types of women, and they're sort of, while they might have similarities about some things, I think they all have interesting and distinct professional paths, personal paths, and that sort of ties into how they're actually running for president. And so I'm hoping to write about that as things go on, and I chose Kamala Harris as the first person to write about, in part because she in particular seemed to be coming up a lot in this quote-unquote electability debate that we've been having. Mm-hmm. Harris has gotten a lot of, you know, people saying, oh, she would be a great vice president. Is she electable enough? How do people feel not just about a woman, but a black woman? I should note that Kamala Harris is not the first black woman to run for president. Shirley Chisholm, of course, ran for president and had, I think, a pretty great slogan, never bought or bossed, which is like,
there you go,
put it on a t-shirt. But, you know, I think Harris has this also interesting comparison to Barack Obama. And I started to see a lot of sort of ways that she handles people's fascination with her personal identity and some of her, if not discomfort, her wanting to always sort of say, yes, but I've done all these other things. And I kind of quote a David Axelrod interview from 2017, right when she first got into Senate. And within the first, you know, minute, he wanted to know about how her identity shaped her. And she wanted to talk a bit more about her accomplishments and career. Anyway, we can talk more. But I talked to a lot of people who, you know, had managed her campaigns and just sort of the interesting way that she has handled these electability questions in the past that I think have a lot to do with her being a black woman in the world, but also mixed race woman in the world, but also wanting to sort of be seen for her quite accomplished career.
We're going to talk a lot more about Kamala Harris, but Amelia, I want to bring you in here because you're sort of looking at the research overall and past elections and different types of elections. What do we know in general about what it's like to run for president of the United States as a woman? Obviously, Claire said, you know, everyone's basing their assumptions off of Hillary Clinton. Is that basically all we have? And then everything else we have to base off of congressional, Senate, gubernatorial elections? What do we know?
So this definitely is a challenging topic because, in a sense, at least in terms of the general election, we do kind of have an N of one, which is the 2016 election. Women have run in presidential primaries before, obviously, including Hillary Clinton in 2008. So that is one place we can look. But it is just kind of a tricky area because when you look at the research on gender and politics, it is a lot of taking findings from congressional elections where there's a lot more data or even state legislative and local races or gubernatorial races and saying, okay, let's look at, you know, whether women are less likely to win overall, sort of how women are perceived by voters. And we're taking that and extrapolating a lot of it to the presidential context. And so, you know, we do have a lot of information about what it's like to run as a woman in American politics. But one of the big challenges is then sort of taking that and saying, okay, how much of that is actually going to apply in a presidential race? And then also, how much do we really know from this relatively small set of cases where we have seen women running for president, either in the primaries or the general?
So there's some like messy inferences maybe going on here. I mean, what in general do we know from whatever other elections that people are basing their assumptions off of? What do we know about how women are treated when they run for office, what their prospects are, things like that?
There are kind of two contradictory, or maybe not like directly contradictory, but sort of two things that you have to hold in your head at the same time when you're thinking about women's chances running for office. The first is, you know, I think to no one's surprise, voters have gender stereotypes in general, and they also have expectations about what sort of they expect a politician to look like, what they expect a leader in elected office to look like. And a lot of the traits that we tend to associate with leaders and politicians also line up with expectations for what men do and are. And so women, you know, in that sense, kind of from a theoretical perspective, and we do see some of this in the research, that women are just, they're facing a pretty big barrier insofar as our idea of what it means to be a leader is gendered male. On the other hand, when you look at actually how women do when they run, they win at about the same rate as men, which is not really what you would expect based on all of the literature about gender stereotypes. And I think just sort of people's experiences of being in the world and maybe being in the workplace and dealing with gender stereotypes. And, you know, it also doesn't, candidates' gender doesn't really seem to have an impact on the amount of money they can raise. You know, there may even be some senses in which gender stereotypes are helpful for women. There's sort of some studies that have suggested that it's harder for scandals to hurt women. And so it's, you know, it's kind of this challenge. On the one hand, how much can we really take from congressional races and say, you know, okay, women run and win. When women run, they win at about the same rate. Does that really apply in the presidential context? On the other hand, it does sort of push back on this idea that women are facing an electorate that is less willing to vote for female candidates, because on the whole, when women run, they actually, they do better than, you know, I think a lot of people might expect.
In part because a lot of times, and there's been studies to track this, that women who run for office do so at a point in their career when they've accomplished more things. So women who decide to get into political races might come in with, you know, let's say 2 decades of experience versus a man, the average male political candidate who might come in with a decade or so of experience. But I do think, you know, playing into that, the idea that a lot of these women who are in the race are probably, have probably more ironclad resumes, let's say, on the whole, than I can think of a few of the people, the white men who have gotten into the race in the past few weeks, in part, and we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, because there's nothing really, there's no real barrier to entry, right? It's just sort of, yeah, this is good for my profile. This is good to run. But yeah, I think this, the idea that we are in a bit of a messy period with all of these, how do we see women running for president differently than, you know, women running for Congress and feeling like, okay, it's good to have a woman congressman or woman senator, but where do our notions of sort of leadership, you know, the almost like militaristic ideas of what it is to be the leader of a country, because, you know, the commander-in-chief is the commander of the armed forces. There's lots of stuff that are imbued in the modern American imperial, dare I say, presidency. And I think that there's been some interesting stuff that people have written about when we have these conversations in the media about electability for women, electability for minority candidates. How much are we amplifying doubt in people's mind? The mm-hmm. idea that, you know, as a writer or as a pundit, someone might say, well, there are people who think that, you know, it might be more difficult for a woman to get elected. How much does just saying that put it out into the world that this is a thing that people are saying? And I think that's a really difficult question to ask, because there is a basic, we've never had a woman president, obviously. I think women navigate professional life and public life in very different, interesting ways. You can just be a woman in the professional world and know that people might treat you differently at times. This is very random, but there's a podcast that I think kind of captures this well. It's the long form podcast interviewing a journalist called Vanessa Gregoriadis. And she wrote a book about rape and sexual assault on college campuses. But she has this very interesting interlude. I went back and looked at it today. I think it's about the 15-minute mark. It maybe starts where she talks about how women are very used to being, to having their personal lives, or their almost like, I don't know how to put this other than like sexual currency or sort of newness or interestingness as a woman, as like this different thing, play into their career and play into their lives. And now obviously there aren't like 24-year-olds running for president, because that's illegal. We're not you're not qualified for office under the Constitution. But the idea that we have so much more interest in women's private lives, in the way, including these women who are running for president, in the way that these women present themselves, in, you know, these preconceptions that these, that their previous experience in life might leave them at some deficit to be the commander-in-chief, is an interesting, fascinating question, and one that I think if you are a woman, as I am, it is fascinating, because there is sort of this idea that, why do people feel that your sex, some people, right, that your sex might be in some way a demerit point? And I think that is a very fundamental and basic question, but fascinating nonetheless if you really squint at it and think about it for a long time.
So we've, thank you for sharing all of that. And also kind of, we've started to lay out the complicated obstacle course of questions and considerations and so on when it comes to a woman running for president. So how specifically in, you know, you did a whole profile on Kamala Harris. You followed her on the trail and talked to people who know her well. How is she navigating all of that?
Well, I think she leads with, as I said before, accomplishment, right? She is, I mean, she has written a book. I don't know if I would, I guess it has autobiographical elements, and she does talk about her childhood and her family, but it's not really a, to bring up Barack Obama, it's not a, is it Dreams of My Father, Dreams from My Father? I think it's Dreams from My Father. Anyway, it's not that kind of really introspective, inward-looking thing about what does it mean to be me with this identity in America and to have, you know, a 200 or so pages about that idea and that journey and that struggle. She does talk about her race and identity. I don't mean to, in her identity as a woman, I don't mean to say that she doesn't. But so much of what I think Kamala Harris does on the campaign trail is talk about how she has used her life experience to further public policy, things like that. And this is really interesting that Jim Stearns, who was her first campaign manager when she ran for San Francisco district attorney, told me, you know, I've spent a lot of time with Kamala. She's very warm. She's very down to earth. But he said, I never knew anything about her private life. She usually frames things within issues. So it's not necessarily about herself. And a lot of people said that to me, which is she doesn't want to make it about Kamala Harris, mixed race American woman. She wants to say, yes, this is who I am in the world. We are all bodies and minds and spaces. You know, we take up space in the world in a particular way. But people talked about she is more comfortable with talking about what she has done as far, you know, to push that forward. And obviously, she's gotten a lot of pushback for being a prosecutor. That's, you know, there's a lot of people, particularly as the Black Lives Matter movement has a lot of influence in the American Democratic Party at this point in time. I think a lot of people see her being a prosecutor as a bit of a yikes, right? Like, that's not a good thing. And she'll talk about, well, I wanted to change the system from within. That was kind of how I approached my politics of the personal, which I think is really fascinating for a mixed race woman in America.
So in a way, she's trying to run a campaign that flies in the face of what you've described as an obsession with women's like personal lives,
right,
and backstories and so on.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you saw it in that 2017 David Axelrod interview. He wanted to know about Kamala Harris, the person. And I think you see a lot of, you know, AOC is a person who has built a lot of her popularity on the idea that she is an accessible person who uses social media to sort of pull back the veil. She's, you know, she takes you into her home and she cooks with you, right? There's a little bit of this sense of, oh, like, I get it. Like, I know her. And I don't think Kamala Harris has that sense that you should necessarily have to know all of her in order to think that she is, if you are inclined to vote with her, the best, most capable person to handle issues and to have the kind of personality type to be president. But there is a real fascination with what women's lives are like. I mean, you'll often hear women now turning, you know, celebrities, if they get asked, how do you balance it all with kids and blah, 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 they'll often, the new thing, which I think is fair, is to say, did you ask a man with children that question, right? So the idea that why are people so fascinated with women's private lives and the way they navigate that in their public life? It's interesting.
So Nate, how is all of this playing out for Harris so far in the race? How's she doing?
Not badly. Not amazingly. She is at about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8% in different polls. She has been a pretty good fundraiser so far. She has high favorability ratings among voters who know her. I'm not sure she's really kind of articulated a clear rationale for her candidacy or kind of established a clear quote-unquote lane. There is some discussion about how she has been subtly trying to pivot away from being more associated with the left toward somewhat more moderate viewpoint. And by the way, a lot of black voters are fairly moderate. Black Democrats are actually more moderate than white Democrats on average, which creates interesting opportunities and problems. You know, look, she still is one of the candidates for whom it's easiest to imagine the path forward. And that path basically probably involves some combination of people saying, you know what, maybe Biden kind of doesn't wear that well on the campaign trail for a few months, and or people think he's too old and too much of a white guy, right, and or too moderate. On the other hand, people think, you know what, Bernie is also really old and also a white guy and too far left for us, and so therefore we have someone who kind of runs right up the middle of the primary, and that would be Kamala Harris, right? So she's someone where, if like, if you tell me a year from now we're wrapping up the last primaries that she won, I'd be like, okay, not too surprising. But there is a little bit of like, you know, is there like a Marco Rubio syndrome where you are not very many people's first choice, that you're deemed widely acceptable, but like there's a little bit more on paper than reality. And then, you know, Rubio was also a guy who was Hispanic, and so maybe that can get a little bit into perceptions. You know, another complicated question is like, if you are both a racial minority, or in her case, two racial minority groups and a woman, how does that interact or intersect, I guess you would say, too? You know, as a dude, I have found the coverage, this is very anecdotal, as a dude, I have found the coverage of Kamala Harris to be less gendered than of some of the other women, than of like Warren or of Gillibrand, for example. You know, I don't know why that is. It's just my anecdotal observation.
I think that's probably right.
Actually, this is I had an interesting conversation with some political scientists about this. And I think it's an important reminder, you know, I think, and your series, Claire, is going to sort of illustrate this, but that, you know, okay, so women face various forms of sexism probably as they go into the primary, but it doesn't affect women in the same way at all. And one suggestion from the research is actually that, you know, being a woman of color, you would think not an advantage in American politics by any stretch, actually can be helpful in a sense, because people are sort of more used to thinking of women of color as being kind of assertive and projecting confidence in a different way. And that, so in that sense, you know, someone like Kamala Harris may not seem like as much of a sort of contradiction in what people expect from leadership than a white woman might. And so that was sort of an interesting reminder for me, just in how these dynamics that we can sort of observe at a kind of macro level are really affecting all of these women in very different ways. And then they're also going to be responding to them very differently. You know, another point that political scientists have made as I've been talking to them is, women respond differently, and that one of the theories for why women actually do better than you might expect they would at the ballot box is they're actually very effective at responding to voters' concerns about sexism and electability. And so one of the things I thought was really interesting about your piece, Claire, was sort of the way that Harris is responding and how she's sort of pivoting away from this focus on the personal. And I think it'll just be really interesting to sort of see how people respond to that and whether that is a kind of effective way of responding to any concerns that voters may have about electability.
Yeah. And just to go back to the Nate point about the coverage of Harris perhaps being maybe feeling less gendered than Warren or Gillibrand in particular, I think that's really interesting. And in part, you know, I might say it has to do with, for Gillibrand, she made her bones over the past couple of years on, you know, these kind of embracing the year of the woman things. She's obviously gotten a lot of flack and a lot of speculation that maybe her coming out so strongly against Al Franken kind of painted her in this unflattering light to a lot of Democrats. And then I think Elizabeth Warren, to me, is the most interesting in some ways vis-a-vis 2016 and Clinton, if only because they're women of similar ages. But I think it's also that they're so, I mean, if you peel past, they are both white women of certain ages. They have such wildly different careers. It's really amazing. Right. I mean, Warren has only been in electoral politics for about a decade. But also, I mean, just to talk about the image making and the sort of, I mean, when you boil it down, I mean, a lot of American politics, I've said this before, I'll say it again, it's political pheromones, it's image making, it's what elicits emotion, right? It's kind of like, it's like that, you know, the E.E. Cummings or like the imagist poets, it's image evokes emotion. And there was this, I think it was two summers ago, I can't quite remember when, but Rebecca Traister had a cover story for New York Magazine on Elizabeth Warren, and the cover line said front runner ? And it was a picture of Elizabeth Warren at an outdoor summer fair running, right? Wearing her kind of trademark open sweater, kind of dressed very casually. She sort of just looks like a regular woman. And to me, that was such a interesting, when we're thinking about what we perceive political leadership to look like in America, it seemed quite the opposite of what our image of older man in formal suit or even rolled up shirt sleeves and dress pants. The fact that this was the, you know, a person running for president, I thought that was a very interesting image-making moment. And I'm not sure how people react to it. I think if you're Warren, that's what you like about her. But she does, you know, maybe just faces some of the idea of, like, she doesn't look and hasn't had the career of a traditional politician, whereas, frankly, Harris and Gillibrand have.
One of the things that you brought up in your piece on something that you've mentioned earlier is when people talk about Kamala Harris and female candidates in general, this idea that, oh, you know, I'm just concerned that other people won't vote for this person. Right. It's not that I won't vote for this person or that I'm sexist. I think that, like, other people are sexist, and therefore I'm worried about supporting them because in the general, they might not be able to win. And this gets into a broader conversation about electability. What do we know about electability? Are people just making random assumptions? And I know, Nate, in our, like, editorial meetings, we've talked about doing a whole series on electability and what we actually know about it. Can you, Nate, tell us a little bit about, at this point, what we do know? Like, are these all just kind of assumptions that aren't necessarily based in fact? And could assumptions shape this whole race if enough people just assume that people won't vote for a woman?
I mean, I do hear from Democratic women friends of mine sometimes that, hey, I would love to support Warren or someone, but I'm not sure that that she can beat Trump. So, I mean, I think that's a real thing. But the question is, you know, is there a reasonable basis to think that? I don't know. I tend to be someone who says I would rather have the larger sample size than the narrowly specific sample size. So what do I mean by that? I mean, like, I am someone on this debate about, like, do you look at the data about women running for Congress and so forth, which would suggest that maybe there's not a huge penalty, or would you look at this kind of, say,
in fact, that there's no penalty.
Yeah. And maybe even an advantage in some ways, right? At least if you have, like, women turn out in higher numbers. Versus, like, the fact that you have had 44 presidents. I'm not counting Cleveland twice. It's just one dude. And they've all been men. And that Hillary Clinton had problems in 2016 that I think at least plausibly had something to do with her gender. Maybe there's a limit on, but, you know, but, like. But
so,
look,
you're saying put more emphasis on the fact that when women run for office, otherwise they do well, instead of overemphasizing Hillary Clinton's experience.
Also, if you ask voters and say, hey, is it going to be a problem if we nominate a woman, about like 8 or 10% say yes. But the question is, are those voters who would plausibly vote for Democratic nominee
right. Anyway?
It's not so clear. By the way, if you ask voters, how would you feel about nominating someone who is over 75 years old? Then, like, half of them say, oh, that's a problem. And so for Biden or Bernie to be running on electability is a little bit, not ironic, but a little bit dubious if that becomes a bigger thing.
But within the universe of people who are likely Democratic voters, this whole, you know, peering over your shoulder to think about who, not who you think is the person who's best fit for the job, but who other people think is the first person best fit for the job. It is really fascinating when you get into women Democratic primary voters, who make up the
majority of the Democratic primary electorate.
Correct. To me, it's a really fascinating question when you're talking to women Democratic primary voters about women candidates, and they're, you know, going through and saying, well, yes, you know, Harris is a calm talker and you need to be that when you're a woman running, things like that. It's not to me so much internalized sexism, so much as like internalized dejection, right? The idea that you have this perception that other people in the world maybe don't doubt you individually as a woman, but just, you know that women are seen as lesser in, you know, subtly or overtly in a lot of ways. You know that there's a lot of violence against women, right? Like the rates of intimate partner violence in America, right? The idea that, Galen, you and I just saw a play about this. We saw What the Constitution Means to Me, which is this really interesting play that, frankly, a lot of it comes down to what it's like to be a woman in America and to have like laws not protect you when there's violence done to you. So this whole idea that women in America rightly and I think reasonably know that there is this undercurrent in society, even among people who love you, who might say things to you or who might say, well, you only got that job because you're a woman and they needed a woman, a diversity hire, right? These things where it's, we do have internalized sexism as women. I think we should be able to admit that. But I think it's this internalized dejection of, well, everyone else is going to think she's not qualified. So, like, I just want to win and beat Trump, right, if you're a woman voter in the Democratic Party. And I think it's such a fascinating psychology because it says so much about our society and how we look for when women come into play, almost like the negatives rather than, as Amelia has said, Well, they actually, women have a pretty good track record.
But I think, Claire, that it's so interesting to see this happening also with voters, because it seems like this has just been an issue, a big factor that's affected women's underrepresentation for a long time, because it's also women look at other candidates and they see sort of the way they're treated on the campaign trail, and they see the media attention. And so you can sort of say to them, okay, you win at the same rate, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to sort of face all of these different barriers. Maybe you can overcome them. But one of the things that folks have mentioned to me as I've been sort of reporting about kind of the broader ecosystem of gender and politics is that one of the big things to overcome just with female candidates, and that seems to be driving a lot of women's underrepresentation in politics, because one of the big issues is that women are just less likely to run, is that sort of women look at what happens to female candidates. And they say, you know, I just don't really want to go through that. Or, you know, you can give me the statistics showing me that I have a good shot of winning, but I don't believe it in a fundamental way.
And it's also, I think, the idea that only, that's really right, Amelia, that the idea that women on the running for office face a lot of challenges, I think goes to this subtler thing of, well, what kind of woman chooses to run for office and is successful at running for office? I mean, I think just to take it from a, you know, like a workplace situation, often I have found in the course of my career that certain personalities of women get paid attention to more, right? That there are, and maybe that's true for politics, right? That maybe Kamala Harris or Kirsten Gillibrand, I don't know, just randomly, have more of the personality that people can see other leaders or men listening to, right? Versus, I don't know, someone else who might have a more subtle style or a more conventionally, quote unquote, like woman's collaborative leadership style, whatever it is. I mean, I have good friends who work in big banks, right? A very sort of very masculine atmosphere. And the idea that only that certain kind of women rise to leadership positions within banks or sort of very machismo driven work cultures, often it is a woman who has perhaps more stereotypical, like, hang with the boy characteristics. And maybe that's happening in politics, and our perception of what kind of woman can succeed in politics is extremely narrow still. It hasn't broadened out to the wide spectrum of women's personalities or just people's personalities, because we all exist in the world in very different ways.
All right. Well, that seems like a good place to leave this, I think. Who's up next? Do you know who you're going to be reporting on
next?
We'll see. All right. Well, I look forward to it. And Amelia, of course, has some forthcoming work on how sexism is playing out in the Democratic primary and in elections in general. So also look for that on the site in the future, along with, you know, plenty more conversations about this topic in general. I think that's all we've got for now. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Amelia.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.